Okay, so do we have sound? Sound, sound, sound. Hello, yes, here we go. Okay, so we're ready to go. Welcome back for the next session. And for the tonight and tomorrow, we're going to be talking about samadhi, okay? Practice of meditation. Tosila Samadhi Panya, and we're talking about the samadhi section. Oops, my computer's about to die. 1 second. Very good. So, actually, the image we got there of you know, just to sort of try to liven it up by finding some images, and I just sort of, you know, Googled image meditation and so on. And actually, if I was redoing, I did these slides a year or so ago, but I would redo it now because I see this image is a young woman, blonde, sitting in nature meditating, right? And this is actually, if you Google meditation, this is very typical of the kind of images that you get for meditation, right? And it seems that, according to Google Images, old people don't meditate. Right? Fat people certainly don't meditate. Ugly people don't meditate. Black people don't meditate. Disabled people don't meditate. And people certainly never meditate in boring, ugly places like bedrooms or something like that. They always meditate in a lake or a mountain top or something like that. And I would like to change this, and anyway, maybe next time I'll change it. But it's interesting to think about, you know, and the lack of diversity there are in images of people who meditate. And just try it when you go home, yeah? Google images and just search for meditation and see what comes up. And it's quite telling, really. And it's also, I find it quite interesting, if you asked 100 years ago, like, who meditates? Well, it would have been old Asian men, right? That's who meditates. Monks, yeah? These days, it's young Western women who meditate. That's what Google says, that these things have changed very fast. Anyway. But of course, according to early Buddhism, it's not just young people who meditate, and it's everyone. And we find that meditation is so central in the early Buddhist teachings. I mean, it's incredibly central, right? I mean, it's every religion. If you look in every religion, they have a contemplative tradition, right? Christianity has it, Islam has it, Hinduism has it, but in no other religion is the contemplative, the meditative image so central, right? The image of a Buddha image is basically the image of a man sitting in meditation, and that's the kind of the core, one of the core things that really distinguishes Buddhism. So as we looked in the beginning, we wanted to look at what is how these things are transmitted. Part of what I want to do through this course is I want to get you to reflect about your own beliefs, about why we talk about Buddhism in this way, why we experience Buddhism in the form that we do. Remember, Buddhism as a tradition, think of Buddhism as like a vast library, okay? And when you walk into a library, there might be 1,000 books on the shelves, yeah? But the only book that actually matters is the one that you pick up, right? The fact that there's 1,000 other books there is completely meaningless if you don't read them. So it's the same thing in the Buddhist tradition. There's so many things in the Buddhist tradition that we can take if we want and we can use, right? But what are those things that we actually pick up and make use of? They're the things that really matter. So, and we do that because, in a way, that knowledge is filtered and directed by language, by association, by connotation, by all of these things. It has its social and cultural context. And meditation, the word meditation, has its own social and cultural context, which we forget. Actually, meditation, of course, is a Western word, an English word, and in England 100 years ago, they didn't have meditation, right? As we know it today, it didn't exist. They had the word meditation, right? But what were they using it for? So here's a bit of background, looking at the etymology from the etymological dictionary of what meditation means. So meaning contemplation, devout preoccupation, devotions or prayer, from the old French, thought, reflection, study, and directly from Latin, meditatio, no, anyway, something like that. meditatio, a thinking over meditation, noun of action from past participle stem of meditare, to meditate, think over, reflect, from the primitive, from the PIE root. PIE means the primitive Indo-European or Proto-Indo-European, and so that's the ancestral language which underlies both Pali and Sanskrit on the one hand, and also most of the European languages on the other. And so in the primitive European root, med, to measure, limit, consider, advise, or take appropriate measures. Okay, so that's the actual root of the word meditation. It's from the same root as the word like middle or median, right? All having the idea of some kind of limit or measure on things, and that's where the root came from. And so on. The more conventional meaning in English until recently was a discourse on a subject, act of meditating, continuous calm thought upon some subject. It's from the late 14th century. The Latin verb also meaning plan, devise, practice, rehearse, study. So the main way that the word meditation means in English until recent times, it basically meant like a reflective thought about something, okay? And so various people published their meditations, which would be like books or passages written which were reflective thought about something. So that's obviously quite a different thing than we think of today when we think of meditation. So in the late 19th century, when the early Indologists were trying to translate these Buddhist ideas into a modern idiom, right? You have to think about it. It's not at all obvious how to do this. For example, T.W. Rhys-Davids coined the term mindfulness, right, to translate sati. And these days we don't think of it, we don't think twice. We think that mindfulness is just a Buddhist word, right? And that's what Buddhism is about, is mindfulness. Well, the Buddha didn't speak English, yeah? So he didn't actually use the word mindfulness. He used the word sati, which is somewhat more, less knowable for us than what mindfulness is, right? And so the fact that we use mindfulness today is determined by particular historical circumstance. Thomas Rhys-Davids invented that word, and it's worked really well. Yeah? Some other terms were not able to translate so successfully. Okay, so this is, anyway, that's a bit of the background. What's meditation? Wikipedia tells us meditation is a practice in which an individual trains the mind or induces a mode of consciousness either to realize some benefit or as an end in itself. Okay, so the idea of training the mind, of course, being a very Buddhist idea. So that's not too bad as a definition of meditation. A few things which are important about that definition. First of all, it's a practice, right? Very, very important. Yeah? So meditation is a practice, and meditation is an experience. It's about the mind. It's about consciousness. This also is quite a modern way of thinking about religions. And certainly in the West, until the beginning of the 20th century, nobody really thought about religion very much in terms of religious experiences. When people thought about religion, they thought about religious doctrines. Okay, so religions were differentiated because they had certain dogmas, certain philosophies and so on, and rituals and all of that kind of thing. And it was actually William James, who was a great American psychologist, who published a book, fantastic book called The Varieties of Religious Experience. Classic work of psychology. If you ever get the chance, then you should really read it. It's probably out of copyright. You can probably find it on Gutenberg and places like that. So The Varieties of Religious Experience. Amazing work. And in there, he sort of puts aside the question of religious dogma and adherence to different beliefs and which one's right and which one's wrong, and looks at what kind of experiences do people have in what we call religion. And of course, by calling it varieties, he's implying, and as he shows throughout the book, that people have all kinds of different experiences. Yeah, and so his book, he sort of gathers them, tells the anecdotes and describes the experiences. And so it's all about trying to get some sense of the subjective experience that people have in religion. And so, you know, this again comes to this point here in this definition. It talks about how an individual trains the mind. So this is something that we understand, that religion and our religious practice of meditation, it's going to vary. It's a variety of experience. Yeah, your meditation is different from my meditation, and You know, this is something that's very, very clear to me when you're teaching meditation retreats, you know. And, you know, when I'm at Jhana Grove and you teach a meditation retreat and there's like 60 people there and you give one talk on meditation and then you hear the interviews afterwards and you realize that you managed to give 60 talks at the same time. Right? And you don't know, this kind of superpower that you have, that everybody in the room hears a completely different talk, right? And they all come away with something, yeah? And so this is when you realize that, you know, this thing is the varieties of experience. And when people meditate, they have very, very different kinds of experiences, okay? So this is something which is important to understand when you're practicing, because sometimes when we talk about meditation, we market it, right? So you know, this is like marketing for meditation, okay? It's very kind of peaceful, everything's very nice and so on. And it's very, oh yes, I wish I could be just like her and she's so peaceful and stuff like that. And you see that on meditation retreats, you know, that this is something that comes up very, very often. You maybe have 60 people in the room sitting and meditating, right? And then people will come in the interviews and they'll say, oh, look, you know, I was had so much anxiety and so much thinking and so on, but everybody else is so peaceful, right? You're the only one, right? But I'm sure that young lady who's sitting there is probably thinking, you know, this is really uncomfortable, or this mosquito is biting me. How long do I have to sit here? Can I? And that's what meditation is, you know, and that's okay. So, our experiences of meditation are very individual. And when we sell meditation, we say you'll become very peaceful and you let go of all of your stress and you'll be very, very happy. And then you actually sit and meditate and you're like, oh, it's really uncomfortable and oh, my back aches. Oh, I can't stop thinking and so on. So, yeah. So, well, what can we say? Yeah. Truth in advertising. Anyway. But there's like a kind of a goal, you know, so there's an aim of where we're going in meditation. And of course we all start in different places, so our journey towards that goal will vary a lot. But what we do tend to find also is that after people have been meditating for some time, that these differences tend to fade away. And that people, when they get some more skill in meditation, then yes, it does lead to that peace of mind and it becomes something that's more reliable and more trustworthy. Okay. So that's what Wikipedia tells us about meditation, but since we're not Wikipediaists, we're Buddhists, so what does the Buddha have to say about meditation? There's no one word in Pali which is identical with the word we use for meditation today, but there are many words which talk about meditation, and this is just a small sample. Okay, there are many other words which are found that talk about meditation in different ways, okay? So I'll just mention these as we go. Citta bhavana, possibly the most general term talking about meditation. Citta means the mind, bhavana means to develop, okay? Citta bhavana, development of the mind. And again, this is an area where in Buddhism, the development of the mind is quite different. It's quite a different kind of thing than we might think normally, and especially if we come from a background in Western education. Normally we think, you know, you train your mind by, I don't know, by exercising it, by doing puzzles, by memorizing things, by working out problems and so on. And so this is how we learn to exercise our mind and train our mind. Whereas in Buddhism, development of the mind really means development of consciousness, development of awareness, right? So all those other things, they might be fine, but the real development of the mind is in clarifying of awareness. And one of the very characteristic things here is this term bhavana, which we find very often in Buddhism. And bhavana is a very subtle term. We translate it as development, but the literal meaning of bhavana is from the root bhu, and it's a causative form. So bhu means to be, and it's a causative form. So it means to make be more. That's literally what bhavana means. So to citta bhavana literally means to make your mind be more. Yeah? In other words, to expand your mind, to enhance your mind, to amplify your consciousness, yeah? To grow your consciousness. Now you can only make something be more if it's there in the first place. Right? So this is also something that's very important to bear in mind with meditation, that you're not making something, you're not creating something from scratch, okay? You're taking the ordinary qualities and characteristics of your mind as it is, yeah, and you're making more of those things. Okay, you're making them better. Yeah, it gives this idea of training. Yeah, just like if you're training for athletics, you know, you make your muscles work better, you make your coordination work better, and your stamina work better, and so on. But you already have those things. So meditation, you're making your mind work better. So that means, for example, that meditation in Buddhism is not about the intercession of some divine entity. All right? So we're not meditating in order that we're going to get some vision from God or something like that, yeah? Nor are we meditating to get some kind of, esoteric knowledge of next week's lottery number or something like that, right? And, people do all this kind of thing. That kind of meditation is very common, certainly in Thailand, and I'm sure in some other Buddhist countries, where people really do that, yeah? And I've heard many stories along those kinds of lines, that monks will actually kind of meditate in order to find out the lottery numbers and so on and so forth. And, so, that's not the purpose of it. The purpose of it is to make your mind be more, yeah? Citta bhavana. Samadhi. Translate as wellness, stillness, perhaps coalescence. Often they translate samadhi as concentration, but it's a very bad translation and we should try to avoid it and move away from that. Samadhi literally means, like the ordinary language meaning of samadhi is used in the context of a fire. Like when you light a fire, you have to gather all the different parts of the fire, the kindling and the sticks and so on, and you bring them all together, yeah? So that the spark will take and the fire will light, yeah? And so that's how the word samadhi can be used in ordinary language and not in a meditation context. So it's giving you some idea of what samadhi actually means in a meditation context, yeah? It means where all of those different aspects of your mind, right, have come together, where everything is in the right place, everything is functioning as it should be, and then that spark can ignite, yeah? The mind can come to life. Yeah? So samadhi in an Indian context is always a very exalted term. Okay? In Hinduism, samadhi is the goal of the path. Samadhi means, in the Ashtanga Yoga, it means the transcendental union of your little limited self with the divinity that is the cosmos. Right? That's what samadhi means, right? And so this is why to translate it as concentration is just kind of completely missing the point, right? So samadhi, of course, we don't have that same metaphysical understanding of samadhi in Buddhism, right? We understand it purely psychologically, but it also is a very exalted term. It's the final factor of the Eightfold Path and it always refers to a very exalted state of mind. Samadhi, jhana. We translate that as perhaps absorption, most of the time in the suttas, jhana and samadhi are simply synonyms, okay? So they refer to the same thing. The root of the word jhana is very interesting. The root of the word jhana is actually a Vedic word, dhi. And in the ancient Vedas, so we're now talking 1,000 years before the Buddha, they had a concept that they called dhi, and dhi was like a kind of divine inspiration, and it's what made poetry come to life in the minds of the Vedic rishis and the Vedic sages, right? They felt that they were filled with this dhi, which was kind of like a divine inspiration, yeah? And one of the most famous verses, probably the most famous verse in the Vedic corpus, is the Gayatri Mantra. And that uses the word dhi there, very interesting. Tad savitur varenyang bhargo devasya dhimahi dhyoyo naha prachodayat. Means that glorious rising sun whose divine radiance impels my mind towards awakening, impels my mind towards consciousness. Huh? And so this is that idea of dhi, is like that inspiration, which in that context is like a hymn to the divinity, which is the sun, which is not just the sun out there, but it's also the sun that is waking me up, literally, yeah, bringing my mind to the out of the slumber of the night and into the bright, clear awareness of the day. Yeah, and so that's dhi, which is that quality of inspiration, which is making that possible. Yeah, so you can see that that's like the root of the word, and so in Buddhism, it still has those kinds of ideas of like a heightened consciousness, a clarity and a brightness of consciousness. But in Buddhism, of course, it's brought about not through the divine action of the sun, but through meditation. Samatha, another word which is more or less a synonym of samadhi and jhana, but in the, literally samatha means a stillness or tranquility, evenness. Vipassana, they almost always translate vipassana as insight, but I prefer the word discernment for vipassana. But anyway, so vipassana is the meditation practice or the meditation, the insight and the wisdom that arises through meditation. One thing just to bear in mind when we're talking about samatha and vipassana is that in modern times, okay, the way that these things are talked about in modern times is quite different from the way that they are talked about in the early suttas. But the difference is quite subtle, and you won't notice it unless you're on the lookout for it. And the meaning of the words is the same. That hasn't really changed. But how they're used is just a bit different. In modern times, what people usually say is you can do samatha meditation or vipassana meditation. So there's like two different kinds of meditation that you can do, right? So you either breath meditation is samatha and you can do that, or, you know, you're doing like Mahasi technique or something, and then that's vipassana, right? But the suttas never talk about samatha and vipassana in that kind of way. Okay, they're not different kinds of meditation objects, okay, which you can do. So this is why, to sort of sometimes apply those modern categories into the suttas, it can be a bit misleading. So in the suttas, samatha and vipassana aren't different meditation objects, they're qualities of your mind. Okay, samatha is the peace of mind which emerges from the practice of meditation. Right, so whatever meditation you're doing, the tranquility that emerges from that is the samatha. Right? Same thing with vipassana. It's not a kind of meditation that you do, but it's the wisdom and the insight that emerges from your meditation practice, and that's what's called vipassana. Okay, so it's just a slightly different way of looking at it. Of course, the reality is that if you have a meditation, right, which is supposed to be samatha, right, so you do breath meditation, okay, you're sitting there, you're making your mind calm by doing breath meditation, well, sometimes an insight will come, right, and you'll be like, hang on, this is samatha, not vipassana, go away, vile insight, I don't want to have wisdom now, right? Yeah? And it's the same thing with doing vipassana meditation. You know, sometimes you might be like on a Mahasi retreat or something, and you're doing the noting, and then suddenly your mind might drop down into deep state of samadhi. Yeah, and it happens, right? So what do? You say, no, samadhi, go away, I'm doing vipassana now. Of course, it's silly, right? So these are just good qualities of the mind, and they emerge through the practice of meditation. So it's true that there are some kinds of meditation which are more conducive to leading towards tranquility or to samatha. And there are other kinds of meditation which are more conducive to leading towards vipassana, alright? And so that's true. And so that's how we understand it in the short term, shorthand. But don't confuse the meditation method with the result of it, which is the samatha and the vipassana. And of course, it should go without saying that in the suttas, these things always go hand in hand, okay? So there's no path of just samatha only or vipassana only in the suttas, that they always go hand in hand. And the suttas actually say if somebody has developed samatha but no vipassana, then they need to find somebody who has developed vipassana and ask them, how do I investigate conditions? How do I see impermanence? Yeah? And if you have vipassana but you don't have any samatha, then you need to find somebody who's an expert in stilling the mind, and you need to ask them, how do I make my mind peaceful? How do I bring my mind to samadhi? And if you have both of them, both samatha and vipassana, then joyful and happy, you should keep on training until you reach full enlightenment. And if you have neither tranquility nor insight, then as urgently as a man with his hair on fire, okay, would rush and try to find some way of putting that fire out, in the same way, that's how urgently you should be trying to find at least some samatha or some vipassana. Okay. Okay, then another word that's used for meditation is anupassana. Anupassana is obviously kind of similar to vipassana, but a little bit different. The V in vipassana means like clear seeing, whereas the anu in anupassana means sustained observation, right? It means a continuous observation and observance. Yeah, so it has a slightly different nuance. We also have the word, of course, satipatthana, which usually translated as the foundations of mindfulness or establishment of mindfulness or something. And I'm translating it here as presence of mindfulness. Actually, if I was going to translate one Pali word as meditation, I would translate satipatthana as meditation. Right. Satipatthana, as it's described in the suttas, essentially is what we mean, right, when we use the word meditation, okay? So when we say, I'm going to go and meditate, right, you usually don't mean I'm going to go and sit in jhanas, okay? Now, you might do if you like meditation's really good, but typically that's not what we mean. What we mean is we're going to sit there and we're going to watch our breath coming in and out and try to still our mind and so on, and that's what satipatthana is, okay? So maybe that's what we should be translating as meditation. Okay, any questions on these terms or other terms? There's many other terms used for meditation, but these are some of the more important ones. Yes, please.
Ajahn, in what situation the Buddha would actually use the word anupassana in terms of like what's the difference between
Anupassana is the normal word that's used to describe the practice of satipatthana. So when it says, you may be familiar in the Satipatthana Sutta, it says contemplating a body in the body, mindful, clearly comprehending, and so on. Clearly comprehending and mindful, and so on. The word that's used, that we translate as contemplating, is anupassana. So it's kaya, kaya anupassi, viharati. Yeah? So it means like a continual observation of the breath, a sustained observation of the body or the breath or whatever we're watching. It's used in other contexts as well, but that's one of the common ways. Yes.
Yeah, Ajahn. Coincidentally, in the Straits Times today, there is in the middle page a Jhanis meditation.
Jhanis monk sitting
in front of the Jain temple. And he was attracting a group of a few thousand to show them that randomly he can remember 500 items randomly given to him.
Okay.
And he attributed that to meditation. Mm. But his motivation is not to show off his power, but to encourage the Indian students to develop meditation so that they can train their mind to and be able to make use of it more in a better manner.
Mm.
So any comment on this this thing of what he's trying to do? Because
somebody mentioned that earlier today. Was well, just to clarify, is he in Singapore or was this an article about
India?
He's in India. Yeah. Why did it suddenly become news?
I don't know. He was in the middle page, a big page, you know. So,
okay.
So you were going to talk about meditation. I'd rather bring it up and ask you why.
Well, the Jains have been doing well from getting in the news recently. Then they had the vegetarian city last week, and now they're meditation. So that's good. Yeah, look, I mean, yes, improving memory is, of course, one of the great things that meditation can do. If you look in the Guinness Book of World Records, the world record for the best memory is a Buddhist monk from Burma. Yay, we win. And it's very true, you know. Actually, if you go on a retreat or something like that, you know, one of the things that you'll find on the retreat is that usually, like if you're on, say, a 10-day retreat, usually for the first few days on the retreat, your memories will keep coming up, like the things that happened before the retreat or things that happened that morning and so on and so forth. But as your mind settles down and as your meditation becomes more clear, then the memories will become deeper. Yeah, your mind will just, not because you're thinking about it, but your mind just throws up a memory from your childhood or something which you hadn't thought about for so many years, and suddenly it's there just like it was there yesterday. And this happens all the time in meditation. Yeah? So this idea of bhavana, the development of your mind, when it's not about training like a particular skill, okay? So sometimes, you know, when people talk about training their mind, they might say, well, you know, you're to train your ability to do analytical reasoning or your ability to do this or that. But with meditation, you're enhancing and improving everything that happens in your mind, right? Your perceptions, your intentions, your thoughts, your memories, your imagination, everything gets better, right? You just cleaned out the whole system. And so whatever you turn your mind to, right, will work better. Now, I have a friend in Sydney who taught his dad to meditate. And his dad's like, oh, really, meditation is just so good. It's just so helpful. I can just get the crossword answers much better than before. Yeah? And whenever he gets stuck on the crossword, he just goes away and meditates for a few minutes, and then the answer will come to him, right? So that's what the Buddha said, isn't it? When your mind is clear, yatha bhuta jnana dasana, you see things as they really are. Now, for some it might be getting the right crossword puzzle, and for some it might be getting enlightened. Yeah? But it's the same principle. Yeah? And so this is why also, you know, we recommend meditation for students. You know, just this morning I was talking to some kids and I was saying, you know, how to get away without studying, right? I was shocked. We were talking to these kids, they're like 8, and they're stressing because of exams. I'm like, what? It's madness. So I said, look, you never have to worry about exams. If you want to pass your exams, number one, pay attention in class, right? Yeah, you don't have to do huge amounts of work, but you pay attention with a clear mind, yeah, in the classroom. Second thing to do, it's really important you want to pass exams, is to be able to summarize what you learned in 4 points, 4 or 5 points. Yeah, and so many times I see people writing notes and things, and it's pages and pages of notes. All that tells you is that they don't really understand what they're doing. Yeah? If you know what you're doing, you can summarize it in a few points. Yeah? And the third thing is do meditation. Meditate if you can, even just for a couple of minutes before the class, sit quietly and make your mind clear. A couple of minutes after the class, sit quietly and make your mind clear. Before the exam time, yeah? If you can meditate, then all of that knowledge, right, is in your mind. Yeah, you think about that knowledge as like an impression or a pattern. Now, the more your mind is clear and the more you pay attention at that time, then the stronger the impression and the stronger the pattern that will make in your mind, and the easier it will be to recall later. So if you make your mind very peaceful, listen carefully. Make sure you understand while you're listening. Don't just let the words sort of drift over you and think you sort of absorb it because you're in the same room. No, you have to actually understand what is said, reflect on it, right? Ask questions to clarify. Right? It's the biggest cause of people forgetting things and getting when they're confused about them, right? But if you clarify what you're doing, then you'll remember it even many, many, many years later. Yeah? And so then when you meditate, then all of that knowledge will come. And I really believe that we never forget anything. Yeah, I believe that all that knowledge is somewhere in our consciousness, right? And so the real thing is, how do we remember? Yeah. So anyway, so that's why I told the kids.
Comment on the.
I told the kids they didn't have to bother.
The marketing and the show off aspect of this news. The show off and the marketing aspect of yeah. this news. Would you like to comment on that?
I'd rather not pass judgment on that. I mean, if he's using it genuinely to help people, then that's all right. It's a bit of theatre, you know, so I don't really have a problem with it. Yeah. I mean, it's the sort of thing which can get corrupted very easily, right? But I don't know. That's all right. As long as he's clear about his intentions. Yes, please.
Is visualization the same as meditation?
Well, visualizations are a form of meditation, as we see through this, you know, these terms. Actually, there's many different kinds of things which can be called meditation. Yes, you find visualization in early Buddhist meditations. It's not so prominent as it was in, say, the Tibetan tradition. But what we do find, the visualizations in the early Buddhist meditations are always very simple visualizations, right? So it's usually visualizing a color. Or at the most complex, it might be something like the parts of the body or something like that. But it's still something which is quite simple and which has a sort of basis in reality. So this very elaborate visualizations which you find in the Tibetan tradition, you don't find those in the early Buddhist texts. Yeah. So different people will respond to meditation. You know, some people really love those visualizations. I can never do it. I just sit there and go, I never could make them work. The other one that I could never do properly is koan meditation. You know, you're supposed to have all these paradoxes, which you know, you're supposed to sort of stump your mind. And I hear these paradoxes and I go, yeah, makes sense, yeah. They all seem to, they all seem to be perfectly logical to me. I don't know why that's so, but anyway, so I've never worked with koan meditation. Anyway, go on.
Hi, Ajahn. So my question is, just now we're talking about meditation helps you to increase memories, probably become smarter. On the other aspect, how does it help in terms of regulating your emotions? Like, you know, if you have like emotion problems,
right?
Yeah, how does meditation, you know, help you on that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's actually another question that I was asked this morning. We were having breakfast, and this girl's like 10 years old, and she asked me, how do I control my emotions? I'm like, what? You're 10! You should be asking me that when you're 40. I mean, come on. Oh, it was really amazing, actually, that someone had that much self-awareness to be able to realize that that was a kind of an issue and that there was something up. I was pretty blown away, actually. But yes, meditation is, you know, this is a crucial skill, especially to be able to develop your emotions in a, to go further, okay? Now, you use the term to regulate your emotions, which is like a psychological term, and that's kind of relevant, especially in the case of people who are kind of a bit out of control, right? And so they're suffering from depression, or they're suffering from fits of rage, and all of these kinds of things. And in that context, they do need to learn how to regulate their emotions. From the meditation point of view, to use the word regulate is probably a bit misleading, but it's more about identifying and recognizing what are those positive emotions and developing and making more of them, and those things which are negative emotions, and then allowing them to letting go of those things. Yeah. So in a sense, it's regulating, but it doesn't have that same sort of controlling aspect to it. Yeah. Meditation can be very useful for people who have problems in regulating their emotions, but that depends on the particular case. And so we need to be a bit cautious about how we apply that. So some people who have some kinds of emotional and psychological disorders can be helped very greatly by meditation, but it's certainly not going to help everybody who has those kinds of disorders. And if there's somebody who has some kind of fairly extreme kind of emotional or psychological disturbance, okay, then I wouldn't generally not recommend meditation unless they're under the guidance of somebody who really knows what they're doing. Yeah? So don't think that meditation is a sort of blanket solution to everybody's problems. Yeah? The main purpose of meditation is to start with what Freud called everyday neurosis. Okay, so Freud said the best we can do through therapy is get somebody to a state of everyday neurosis, right? It's not actually mentally healthy, but you get by, right? And that's where therapy leaves off, right? It lets you function, right? It lets you cope from day to day. So with meditation, the main purpose of meditation is to go beyond coping, right? Beyond just getting by, and by to say, where can we take this? We have this mind, which is this amazing thing. Where can we go with that? Yeah? What are the limits? Huh? So, okay, yeah. Mostly in the suttas, yes, it's a synonym. Yeah, the right samadhi is always defined as the four jhanas. Yeah. All four jhanas. All four jhanas is sama samadhi. Yeah. Okay, so why do we... Yes, my apologies.
Bande, are we supposed to have goals before we start meditating? Like, for example, I want to, you know, achieve jhana, or I want to, you know, have a better memory or something like that. Is that okay to do?
That's okay. I mean, people, we have goals, right? I mean, people's, actually, that's what I'm talking about the next few slides is your goals to meditate. But, basically, it's okay to have goals, but just don't fixate on them too much. Yeah. You'll have to let go of all those goals sooner or later, right? But, you have sort of interim goals, that's alright. But don't worry about it too much. Anyway, but this, the next few slides are talking about goals. Why do we meditate? To relax. Right. So relaxing is good, but you know, he looks pretty relaxed, doesn't he? And he's probably not meditating. So, what, to be more loving, Yeah? Meditate, overcome hatred. And so even the most ferocious of beasts in the wild, yeah, can know what it's like to love each other. To see, oops, I misspelled there, to see the God within. Yeah? So there's a kind of religious motivation for meditating, that we want to see some divinity. People, you know, Christians will meditate, they want to see Jesus, or the Hindus will want to see Brahma or something like that. So it's to find some kind of divine revelation. Sometimes we might meditate to gain special powers. Yeah? Do you know who Lobsang Rampa is? Yes? No? Few people have heard of Lobsang Rampa? Lobsang Rampa is very, very cool, right? Yeah, he's awesome. He was this Englishman who in the mid-20th century wrote this series of books, the first one, The Third Eye, a very famous book, and about his supposed experiences in meditation. And his books were completely outrageous. And he talked about his time as a Tibetan monk and so on, and how he went up there and practiced and got all these different kinds of meditations, and his book is just completely over the top. One time his publisher began to be suspicious of him and didn't think that he'd really been to Tibet. So because remember in those days, you know, in England, nobody really knew much about Tibetan Buddhism and stuff, right? So they asked, he came in and the publisher learnt some words in Tibetan, okay? And learned how to say good morning in Tibetan, right? So when Lobsang Rampa showed up at the offices, he said to him, good morning in Tibetan. And he just froze, right, for a second, and then dropped down in a faint on the floor. Yeah? And so when he came back, he told the publisher, he said that after his time as a monk, he spent time as a spy for a secret organization, during which time he'd been brainwashed and all of his knowledge of Asian languages had been removed from his brain. So that if he ever heard of these things, then he would become unconscious, right? So that's pretty quick thinking to come out of that. And then, right? I mean, you've got to give it to the guy. And that became the subject of his next book, right? So then he wrote a book about all his experiences as an international monk spy and stuff like that. And then in his later books, he was like going up in UFOs and visiting alien civilizations in the center of the galaxy and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, he was completely out there. So anyway, this is some of the reasons why people like to meditate, right? To get all these special powers and to see all these different kinds of things. And it can be very fun and very popular, certainly in places like Thailand. I mean, I mention Thailand only because I'm most familiar with it, but I'm sure in lots of Buddhist countries there are lots of these kinds of things going on, and people will be talking about the different devas and things that they're seeing and the different realms and all of that kind of stuff. Who knows? Some of it may be true, I don't know. Most of the time it seems like a kind of overly active imagination and a dearth of a critical faculty. Okay, why meditate? To actualize our spiritual energies, right? So this is a kind of a new age way of thinking about meditation, a sort of vaguely Hindu kind of thing. We want to have more energy, we raise up the kundalini and so on and so forth. And through meditation we sort of come to a higher spiritual plane. Another way of meditating, so we can be really, really peaceful. Yeah? Anyone remember this guy? Yeah? He was the so-called Buddha boy of Nepal, who was very famous, it was about four or five years ago now, wasn't he? And he sat under that tree for how long? Five or six months? Yeah? And he just sat there, and sat there, and sat there, right? You think like half an hour's a long meditation, an hour's like really pushing it. He was there for like 6 months, and they tested him without cameras, and they put cameras on him for like a week or something like that, and he just didn't get up, and he just stayed there. And you had all these Western, I saw this documentary, and you had these Western doctors saying it's impossible, it can't happen, but then obviously it was happening, right? And he just sat there and meditated. So eventually, because it's in India or Indian cultural region, so any kind of great spiritual person sort of becomes a circus eventually, so they kind of built up all these camps around him and little buses coming in and tourists coming and so one day they all went there and he disappeared, right? He obviously had enough of it and he just wandered off, and we haven't heard of him since, so I guess he's just disappeared somewhere. Apparently he had ordained as a novice in a Tibetan monastery in India, so he's actually ordained, but then he just a young guy, and he just sat there to meditate. So, yeah. So I hope he's still somewhere off in the mountains meditating, yeah, in Nepal or something. He came out. Okay. And then what happened after that? Do you know? He has given some talks and things. He's quite young, isn't he? Yeah. Not your typical teenager. Okay, and then last reason to meditate, to be free. Yeah? And, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, that is the goal, yeah? Freedom and nibbana, to be able to let go. So meditation is not an end in itself. All of the other things which meditation can be good for, and developing your memory and all of those things, that's great. All of those things are good. But ultimately, we meditate in order to be free. Okay, let's do a short meditation. Moving on. So, yes. From suffering. Sorry?
Okay, to be free, what I understand is, okay, from the mental suffering, is that correct?
No.
So what?
Well, you're free from all kinds of suffering, not just mental suffering.
Can you give, example?
Well, it says sabbe sankhara dukkha, all conditions are suffering. Yeah. So we have physical pain, we have mental pain. Yeah? Ultimately, even just existence in the conditioned realm is suffering. Yeah. Even if you're sitting in the most deep jhana or something like that, you're not experiencing any mental suffering, but it's still dukkha. Yeah. So freedom is freedom from all of those things. Yeah? Okay. So meditation is a process. Meditation is conditioned, okay? Because it's conditioned, that means that we can train it, and we can identify what are the things that conduce towards having a more peaceful mind or towards having a more disturbed mind, right? And by using those conditions skillfully, we can develop our mind in the way that we want to, in the way to lead into the ending of suffering. So we can't force our mind to be a certain way. You can't just make it be like that, right? So what we do is we try to put into place those conditions which we repeat and we keep on going again and again and again, which will gradually lead in that way. And one of the things that this does is it assures us that when we're practicing and we're developing our spiritual practice, that it's going in the right direction, because we start with the basic things. We're practicing harmlessness and so on. So once we have a good grounding on harmlessness, so we know that whatever we do in terms of our meditation, we're not going to develop in a way that's going to harm anybody. Huh? So it gives us confidence. And it also means that when we see how our meditation works in a context, right, then that gives it some meaning. And sometimes we can hear stories of people who have extraordinary experiences, but it's hard to know what the context was. I mean, the one everyone knows today is Eckhart Tolle, right? And he had this kind of amazing kind of breakthrough experience or something. But then what was the practice? What was he actually doing? It's hard to really know what he's talking about, because it's not clear what the process is. Another good example historically was Krishnamurti. And he, you know, he had this kind of, some kind of insight or breakthrough or experience. And he obviously had some kind of quite profound experience, but it's very difficult to work out exactly what that was. And it's very difficult to replicate it. So what we want for a spiritual practice is we don't just want something that some extraordinary people can have for some strange or unknown or unrepeatable reasons. We want something that everyone can do and which is going to be beneficial, well, maybe not for everyone, but at least for a large number of people. And so we break down the path and we look at those things that are important and practice them in sequence. And of course, this course we're looking at Sila Samadhi Panya, Ethics, Meditation and Wisdom. If we consider that ethics is a foundation for meditation, then how are they linked? So each of the precepts, if we look at the different precepts, can be seen as helping to counteract and overcome a particular kind of defilement in your mind. Okay, so we took the five precepts earlier. So if you have a look at those, for example, the first one, Panatipata, to not kill living beings, obviously this is overcoming or counteracting the forms of anger and hatred. Yeah? And so to refrain from stealing, again, to counteract the forms of greed. Yeah? Refraining from sexual misconduct is, again, counteracting those forms of greed. Refraining from lying, right? Musavada is delusory behavior, right? You're increasing your delusion of yourself and others by lying, by creating false beliefs and so on, and as is consuming alcohol, right? So that creates especially delusion, but actually all of the above really are created and enhanced by alcohol. So at that level of the precepts, we're counteracting the defilements, the strong forms of defilements, and of course all of the ethics in Buddhism can be understood in that same way. So by doing that, we're setting the stage for meditation. So if you, you know, something that's quite common these days is that people take meditation out of context and people like walk in off the street and do a meditation retreat and they're not really keeping precepts and things like that. And that's kind of okay, right? It can work to some degree, but it's going to be pretty shallow. And until someone's actually willing to start questioning their life and their choices and how they're living their life, then whatever they do in the meditation is not going to go all of that deep. Yeah. So another thing that I'm mentioning here is the power of reflection and the power of cultivation, Patisankhabala and Bhavanabala. And these are two kinds of strengths or powers that are mentioned in the suttas, reflecting the ability to look back over things, to reflect on them, to try to understand them, to investigate them. And also through meditation, through clarifying your mind. And the suttas actually mention both of these kinds of things very frequently. So don't think that in the suttas, you know, meditation is only about, you know, watching your breath and making your mind peaceful, and that's the only kind of meditation that the Buddha taught. Actually, there are many different kinds and many different kinds of reflections which are taught in the suttas. We find them constantly, yeah? So very, very well-known ones might be, say, the reflection on birth, aging, and death. You know, I too am subject to birth, I won't escape from that. I too am subject to aging, I'm subject to death, I'm the owner of my karma, the heir to my karma, and so on. And so you use these as like reflections. Sometimes people, we do the food reflection as well, is another one. And before you eat, you reflect that you know, on the purposes of eating the meal and so on. And so these are also a kind of meditation. They're a kind of way of training your mind. And so that kind of more active, reflective form of meditation is also needs to be a part of what we're doing. Okay. So willpower or pleasure, and this is a very important topic in meditation, and perhaps I think the single greatest area where modern teachings on meditation are quite misleading and cause, I think, a lot of unnecessary stress and suffering in meditators. And if you read most popular guides to meditation, it will say something like that meditation means you sit down and you try to concentrate on your breath or on some kind of meditation object. I use the word object. The Buddha never used the word object to talk about meditation. And so then you try to make your mind peaceful and you try to stop your mind from thinking and so on and so forth. And of course people hear these instructions and they sit down and they completely fail. They don't mention that bit in the meditation, the instructions, do they? You try to stop thinking and fail because that's what's going to happen, right? and sitting down and trying to stop thinking and trying to concentrate is not going to work. And we should have learnt that from Yoda, who said, do or do not, there is no try. Right? Right? So we haven't been listening to our teachers. So, have a listen to how, this is a typical example of how the Buddha is talking about meditation, right? Now, the Buddha talked about meditation in many different kinds of ways, okay? And in the readings for this class, we looked at a few of those different ways. But this is a very typical one and a very beautiful one. For a person endowed with virtue, with sila, there is no need for an act of will, right? There's no need for them to wish. May freedom from remorse arise in me. It is in the nature of things that freedom from remorse arises in a person endowed with virtue. For a person who is free from remorse, there is no need for an act of will. May joy arise in me. For a joyful person, there is no need for an act of will. May rapture arise in me. For a rapturous person, there is no need for an act of will. May my body be serene. It's natural that someone who's raptured, their body will be serene. For a person who's serene in body, there is no need for an act of will. May I experience pleasure. It's natural that they will experience pleasure. For a person experiencing pleasure, there's no need for an act of will. May my mind coalesce as one. May my mind go into samadhi. It's natural that your mind will go into samadhi. For a person whose mind has gone into samadhi, there's no need for an act of will. May I know and see things as they actually are. And then there's no need for an act of will. May I feel disenchantment. May I grow dispassionate. May I realize the knowledge and vision of release. And the summary of that sutta, in this way, dhammas lead on to dhammas. Dhammas bring dhammas to their consummation for the sake of going from the near to the further shore. So this is a very beautiful sutta and a very wonderful reminder of this notion of conditions. Remember, the core Buddhist teaching, the heart of Buddhism, is dependent origination, cause and effect. Right? None of these things come by magic. None of these things come by forcing, not by the will of God, not by because some monk has come along and give you some special blessing, or because you've gone on the right retreat, or because you've managed to finally get the perfect meditation cushion, or any of those things, right? And they happen because of dhamma, right? Dhammas lead on to dhammas. That's just conditions, right? Certain conditions lead to other conditions, right? So in our meditation, it's not about us going and saying, you know, I want to do this, I want to get that. You know, who made you the boss, right? When did you get appointed the boss of your own mind, right? I mean, we have this delusion that we're the boss of our own mind. I mean, it's ridiculous. We try telling your mind what to do, yeah, see how far it gets you. Yeah, so it's not, if you try to use control and so on at this developing meditation, it will not get you very far. And you've heard, I hope you've heard Ajahn Brahm teach about this many, many times. And he's one of the teachers who's really emphasized this idea so much in his meditation teachings. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring forth this sutta was to show you that when Ajahn Brahm and myself and other teachers say these things, we're not just making it up. Okay? It's not just, you know, we're not just telling when we say to you, just don't relax and don't force things in meditation. We're not just saying it because we think that, you know, we think that there's a nice thing to say or something. We say it because that's the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha said. And that's, why did the Buddha say it? Because it works. Okay? Because that's how nature goes. Yeah? So it's about cultivating the conditions. When the conditions are there, the more we can get out of meditation, the better, right? And so these days I often tell people that the purpose of a meditation method is to distract your mind from the meditation. Okay? The reason we give you meditation methods is to give you the impression that you're doing something useful, right? So that you don't stuff things up too much. Okay, and I'll give you a little simile to illustrate that. There's a man who's walking along, and he comes to a pond, and in the pond there's another man who's thrashing about in the pond, and stomping around here and there, and he looks at him, and he's like putting his hands on the water and pushing down on the water, And so the other man says to him, what are you doing? And he says, well, see, this pond is dirty. I can't see through the pond. I want to see the bottom of the pond, and I can't because of all the mud. So I'm trying to push the mud down to the bottom of the pond. Right? So he's stepping around in the pond and trying to push the mud down to the bottom. And that's what mostly we're doing in meditation. We're thrashing around inside our minds. Every step that we take, we're stirring up more mud, and we somehow think that we're going to get the mud and push it down to the bottom and make it stick. Yeah? And so the person who's walking along says, oh, okay, well, that's very nice. He says, you know, I've got a little a technique that can help you to be able to push the mud down to the bottom of the pond. He says, oh, what can you do? He says, I'm getting exhausted. I've been doing this for such a long time, and I don't know, it just seems to be getting more and more mud. He says, well, I've got a very effective mud pushing down to the bottom technique. He says, okay, what do you do? He says, well, I want you to collect these things for me. I want you to collect some wood, some nails and hammers, some grass. I want you to get a fire going, a pot of water, and a cup and saucer. Okay, so he gets these things and he says, okay, now you come and you do this, and you build, and he had him build a bench and a gazebo by the side of the pond. And then he boiled a cup of the water and he sat down and had a cup of tea. And then by the time he'd done all that, the pool was nice and clear. And he could sit there and drink his cup of tea and watch the pond, which was nice and clear. Yeah? So that's a meditation technique. Eh? The point is to get you out of the way. Your mind will become peaceful all by itself. Right? This is what that sutta's saying. You don't have to do anything, right? You keep your precepts, you do all the right things, you just sit there, your mind will become peaceful. Why will it become peaceful? Yeah? Anicca vata sankhara, because all conditions are impermanent, yeah? Desang rupasamo sukho, and their stilling is happiness. Yeah? Everything that happens in your mind, right? It's going to come to an end. Whether you like it or not, every thought that you have is going to finish. Every memory that comes to you is going to end. Every vision, every imagination, every plan, everything is going to come to an end regardless of what you do. And if you sit there and think, I'm going to keep thinking this thought forever, and you try, I'm going to keep having this feeling, and I'm going to keep feeling this feeling for as long as I can, right? It's gone by the time you've even finished saying that. Yeah? So everything that's going on in your mind, it's going to disappear. Yeah? Don't worry about that. That's not your problem. Yeah? It's the nature of things, is to allow those things to disappear. Just be peaceful and be patient and wait and let them become peaceful and enjoy that peacefulness. Yeah? So you be like that man who just sits there and has a nice cup of tea and just watches and the beautiful clear pond. Yeah? Is there any questions before we go on? Yeah.
Ajahn, let's say for the meditation, right? Let's say we have, there's a lot of meditation teacher around. Is there a possibility that some might not be teaching the right meditation? Because I heard of some of my friends who attend some meditating course. End of the day, she go bonkers, you know.
And so, they go bonkers.
Yeah, bonkers. That's right. The thing is that even in the Mahayana, even in the Theravada, you know, who can we say that this meditation is the right method? Because, you know, some of them, they might be teaching the wrong
one.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a problem over here, you know what I mean?
Yeah, usually, okay, so two separate questions there. But usually, any kind of sort of fairly normal meditation is usually fine, okay? So the problem, you know, all the, you know, vipassana and breath meditation and metta and all of those kinds of things, that's not going to be a problem, okay? If there is a problem with those things, it's a problem not with the meditation but with the extreme attitudes or ideas. Sometimes people get very dogmatic about their meditation. You know, you can only do this meditation, you can't do any other meditations. And that's this kind of dogmatic attitude. The meditation itself is fine, but there's no need to be so dogmatic about it. The Buddha didn't say that kind of thing. The Buddha was very flexible in his approach to meditation. They're just methods. So, you know, the only kind of methods that I would be suspicious of intrinsically would be methods that had a wrong intention, right? So if people were teaching you to gain some kind of psychic power or to get money or something like that, then I'd be suspicious of those kinds of things. But generally, any normal meditation should be fine. But when problems arise, they usually come because we do them in an extreme way. And I do think that sometimes the way that meditation is taught is a bit irresponsible these days, and we take people off the street with very little vetting and concern for them, and we throw them into very, very intensive meditation settings where they're completely divorced from their social environment. They're not allowed to talk. They're separated from their family. All of the things that normally keep you sane are stripped away from you, right? And you just look into that hideous black chasm of your own mind for 10 days with no veil between yourself and the cold, hard reality, right? And that's incredibly challenging. Now, some people do that and they thrive, and a lot of people get a lot of benefit out of it. But some people, it's just too much. So, yes, sometimes people will go crazy and they have psychotic breaks and things. Again, it's not the meditation method as such which is the problem, but it's the extreme way that it's practiced. So, generally speaking, okay, so that question of people go balmy, I know that quite common as a belief in some cultures. I think in Chinese culture it's quite common for people to say that. And I would like to say that it never happens, but that's just not true, right? It does happen. Mostly what we're talking about here is what they call in psychology a psychotic break, right? And psychotic break, or technical term, is a brief reactive psychosis. And brief reactive psychosis typically happens with some kind of extreme stress. It doesn't have to be meditation. It can be anything. It can be exam times. It can be drugs. It can be grief, pressures at work, anything that just drives you too much and your mind just breaks. And typically that kind of thing will last for a fairly short period of time. And it is treatable, but it can, if it's untreated or if it gets extended, it can go on forever. And if it goes on for a long time, then that becomes what you call schizophrenia. And that can also happen in some cases with meditation. I know some people who are like that. It's very sad, yeah? So I think that it's important that meditation teachers should be a lot more discerning and a lot more careful about these things. When I teach retreats, I always ask before the retreat if anybody has a history of psychological problems. If they're taking any medication, you should always know those things before teaching. And if somebody does have some problems, you should always monitor them very, very closely, see them every day on the retreat, and be very alert to any signs. Yeah, usually there are signs. If people are going to go crazy, there are signs, but they're not usually clear until a few days beforehand. And this is one of the problems, that you can't actually tell until a few days before, and then people start to sort of crack up a little bit. And if you catch it very early, then you can get them to relax, leave the retreat or whatever, or put them under care so that it doesn't get any worse. But yeah, it is something that's a matter of concern. And I think it's something for the BF to think about. If you're running retreats, then typically what I always find is if I'm teaching a retreat, there are always psychologists and psychiatrists on the retreat. And so I always sort of, as well as finding out who maybe has problems before the retreat, I also will approach one or two of the psychologists or psychiatrists and ask them if they're willing to help out with the retreat in case anyone has any problems. So it just means that there's a bit of a safety net. Usually there's no problem. But occasionally then you might ask someone to see and just to check how their symptoms are. Also sometimes to assess if someone's taking medication, what does that mean, right? I mean, someone might say, I'm taking blah, blah, blah. It doesn't mean anything to me, right? It might mean just like Prozac or something. It doesn't mean any problem. But on the other hand, it might be a serious antipsychotic or something. So, it's useful to have somebody there who can say, well, look, this means that somebody's, under treatment for such and such, and they can help. So that's something I certainly would recommend if you're ever organizing retreats or helping to manage the retreats, is to make sure to look after the psychological health of the people on a retreat. Yeah.
Hello, Ajahn. So I have two questions. The first question is, how do we diagnose our own meditation? Should we even try to measure progress?
Uh-huh.
And if we feel that, I mean, how do we measure progress? And if we feel that we are not progressing, right, how do we diagnose the problem and kind of correct it. I mean, I guess my question is like, is there like, you know, when you run marathon, right, there's a training plan, right? Is there a training plan to get into jhana or something? that's the first question. The second question is, in the sutta, the Buddha had two teachers before he became enlightened. And the two teachers were able to go into very deep states of meditation. But what stopped them from going further into enlightenment?
Okay, so first question first, is there a training manual for meditation? Yes, so first step is to give away all your possessions. Second step is to leave your family behind. And third step is to go away and to sit in a cave for the rest of your life without moving. Yeah. So let us know how you go with that. Yeah. Like I said, meditation is very personal and very individual, so it's very difficult to give a blanket answer for that. But generally speaking, you just learn to assess your own progress just by your own reflection. That thing I mentioned earlier, the power of reflection, patisankarbalang, yeah? So to reflect back on your meditation. So when I teach the guided meditations, which, you know, I do here from time to time, then always at the end of it, I spend a minute or two just reflecting back. So you just think back over your meditation. What actually happened? How did my mind work? What changed during that meditation? What was obstructive? What was helpful? And so if you get into that habit of reflecting back on your meditation, then you'll learn about how your mind works. Yeah? Oh, this is what works in that particular case. Oh, that was a letting go. And what you notice when you do that is you notice that in your meditation that there's a moment when your mind just lets go. Yeah, and it's not like a doing, it's not like a trick or something like that, but it's just a letting go, and then your mind becomes peaceful after that. Yeah? So you just train your mind gradually to reflect, and that's really the best way to improve your progress in your meditation. Yeah. So the second question about the Buddha's former teachers, what was their problem? Their problem was the theory. Right? And this is something that almost everybody who discusses this completely misses the context. Right? The context is that the Bodhisattva went to stay with them and first learnt the theory. And he says, as far as lip recital went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance. Yeah? So he learnt the texts. Yeah? So whatever practice he's doing is in the context of that particular theory. And of course the theory will limit what the results are, will influence what the results are. And unfortunately, in the traditional accounts of that, it doesn't tell us what that theory was, okay? But it seems fairly likely that what the theory was something like what we find in the Upanishads, yeah? The pre-Buddhist Brahmanical scriptures, which talk of the Atman, which is the true Brahman, and which is yourself, and that's a purified consciousness, Vijnana Ganameva, as Yajnavalkya puts it, a sheer mass of consciousness. So it seems likely that this is what they were pointing to, was that your real self, your true self, is this ground of consciousness, which is the reality of Brahman and all being. Yeah? So that's actually a very beautiful philosophy, right? And of all the forms of attachment, that's probably the nicest one, right? If you're going to be attached, then fine, be attached to the notion that yourself is identical with the divinity of the cosmos. I think it's a very beautiful idea, but it's still an attachment, yeah? So this is, you know, if you practice meditation and you have these ideas beforehand, then your meditation will tend to confirm those ideas, yeah? So if you're a Christian and you sit and meditate, then Jesus will come to you, yeah? If you're a Mahayanist, then Kuan Yin will come to you. If you're a Hindu, then Shiva will come to you, yeah? Maybe not always. Maybe you're a Christian, you're meditating, and Kuan Yin comes to you, and you're like, wow, this is really confusing. What do I do now, huh? So that might happen sometimes, yeah? But usually, you know, the meditation is what you expect. So this is why, and then so from a Buddhist point of view, then you contrast that with the experience of the Bodhisattva when he's sitting under the rose apple tree. Yeah? And when he sits under the rose apple tree, we talked about this in one of the first classes, he doesn't know any dogma, right? He's just a kid. Yeah, he doesn't know any philosophy. He doesn't know any theory. He's not trying to realize some metaphysical state. Yeah, he's just being peaceful. And so this is why when you see those descriptions of meditation that's found, we just looked at, you know, it's just about letting your mind follow that path of nature and becoming peaceful. Yeah? And so that to me is really what the essence of the Buddhist teaching of meditation is all about.
Uh, Ajahn, I was warned not to meditate because a person might get possessed while meditating.
Uh-huh. Has anybody here ever got possessed while meditating? No? Yeah, we have one over there. He's been possessed with goodness. Okay. That's right. So we have, what, nearly 100 people in the room today? Nobody's ever been... I reckon that's a pretty good survey, yeah? I think the chances of possession while meditating are slim at best. But, of course, whatever... I mean, these experiences of possession, I mean, usually you'd explain them in terms of similar to what we call, like I was mentioning before, the brief reactive psychosis, yeah? But actually, whether it's a demon possession or whether it's your own psychological demons... meditation will usually help. Yeah? But I mean, there are those cases where people have very bad reactions to meditation because they do it unwisely, they do it in an extreme way, they do it without proper supervision. So that can happen. But normally, for most people, if you don't have a history of psychological illness, and if you're reasonably well adjusted and so on, and if you do meditation in a moderate and sensible way, where you're doing an ordinary, mainstream Buddhist meditation, breath meditation, metta meditation, mindfulness meditation, and then you won't have any problems. And actually, you know, it's been shown by countless studies that actually it will improve your mental health and improve your emotional stability. And so if there are any demons around the place, they're not going to worry you, okay? Demons pick on the weak, yeah?
Good evening, Bhante. Just to add on, I think Buddha did not just teach meditation alone, but because Samasati and Samasamadhi is part of the seven and the eight path of the Eightfold Path. So I think a lot of us purely just focus on meditation. That's where we... got into trouble, like following the wrong teacher or get possessed by this.
Yeah.
Because I think the rest of the six factors, like from samadhi, right intention, samasankappa, is also very important, because samasankappa tells us that we must renounce, let go of desire, the one thing, measuring our progress or even getting to jhana.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that is the problem, because a lot of us actually focus on samasati and samasamadhi and forgot that there's a samasankappa that we have to work on.
Absolutely.
And that's why we get into trouble, we get into wrong teacher or get possessed by our own demons. I think that's my comment.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's part of that context, yeah? So,
Ajahn?
Yes, yes.
I have a question. I started learning meditation a few years ago because I felt that it's very fundamental as a Buddhist that the fact that the Buddha gained enlightenment through meditation. But when I started looking for places to learn, I realized that the various methods taught under mainstream Buddhist schools are very greatly different. I mean, metta meditation as one category is quite standard, but in terms of the other, if you want to go a bit deeper into it, like myself so far, the last few years, my focus was on learning the Mahasi method of Vipassana meditation. But I'm also aware that there are various other methods that I have not been exposed to. Like even within Myanmar, there's the Pak Aw method, which is also very different. And I've also not had the opportunity to learn or practice breath meditation, Anapanasati, yet. Or I learned it at a very basic level, but I didn't follow through. So my question is, in the sutta, did the Buddha mention, like, you know, what kind of method he taught or the main technique that he practiced? Because I feel that, like, I still consider myself a beginner, despite that I've been learning for a few years.
Yeah.
That where would be a good place to start? And what techniques would be good to begin with?
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll have a look at a sutta that addresses that. But just, you know, to think about all of those different kind of meditation techniques, you know, ultimately they're different kinds of gazebos and chairs that you're building by the side of the pond. Okay, so you might build a lounge chair or a little hut or something like that. And they're all, yes, they are all quite different, right? But they're actually just doing the same thing, yeah? At the end of the day, It's just a way of allowing your mind to become peaceful. So don't worry about that too much. Actually, you find a big, this is where you find a big difference between the Thai tradition and the Burmese tradition. In the Thai tradition, typically people are not very concerned about meditation methods. And, you know, so if you try to ask what's the Ajahn Chah meditation method, well, there really isn't one. And so, yeah, they teach meditation, but it's not so kind of systematized. It's more personal. It's more individual. And if you go to, you know, if you ask that question of one of the Thai forest Ajahns, you know, should I do Mahasi technique or should I do a Pawak technique or something, and they just say, that's fine, but just be mindful. Yeah, so they're not going to be so worried about what technique you use. So that's why I say, like, all the details of the techniques, if you find a technique which is going to help you, that's great. But don't, you know, just don't get too insistent on it. But let me just skip ahead to a sutta which we were going to discuss later. And so this is a sutta, this actually addresses that very well. And I might just bring it up here now. Because we might, what I'll do is we'll talk about it for a few minutes now, and then we can use it as the basis for the discussion in the discussion section, okay? So this is a sutta called the Meghya Sutta. It was part of the reading that was assigned. And so in the Meghya Sutta, it's a very, very nice sutta. It gives five supports of four meditations. And the background to the Meghya Sutta is also very nice. Meghya was an attendant for the Buddha, and he was walking back from Amsram one day, and they pass a mango grove. And Meghya thinks, oh, that would be a nice place to meditate. So afterwards he says to the Buddha, he says, Lord Buddha, I saw this mango grove, I would like to go there to meditate. Please give me permission. And the Buddha says, wait until some other monks come. And Meghya says, but like, I really, really want to go. And the Buddha says, wait. He says, I'm like, I really, really, really want to go. And the Buddha says, well, since you talk about going off to meditate, what can I say? So Meghya, ignoring the advice of the Buddha, okay, try to wrap your head around that, okay? All right, the Buddha's giving you advice in your meditation, and you just say, no, I'm just going to go and do it anyway, right? So he goes off and he meditates, and his meditation's rubbish, right? He thinks this is going to be such a great place to meditate, and then he has this terrible meditation. He comes back to see the Buddha, and the Buddha says, told you so. All right? Oh, he didn't really, so I just made that bit up, okay? But anyway, he comes back to see the Buddha, and the Buddha then gave him these teachings. The first thing he said is that there's five things that can support your meditation and that bring your mind to maturity. One is good friendship, yeah? Virtue, your sila practice, yeah? So knowing the teachings, knowing the Dhamma, effort, yeah? And wisdom. And so obviously Meghya was somebody who these conditions were not mature in, they weren't ripe. So this again comes back to that thing, that, you know, the idea of meditation retreat or something. I mean, in this case it was even a monk, right? I mean, it's somebody who'd been ordained for a time and had practiced with the Buddha. And the Buddha's saying, actually you're not really ready to be doing this retreat, yeah? So how much more so is it if you just take people randomly off the street and bung them in a room and say, meditate all day, right? I mean, So all of these things are leading the mind to maturity. So that's that context. And then the Buddha then went on to say, to teach Meghya four different kinds of meditation. And these four kinds of meditation are found frequently in the suttas, and they're often sometimes found as a set or independently. But this is, I think, a really nice collection of meditations, and these are probably the most common and the most central meditations we find all the way through Buddhism. And I would strongly recommend that everybody doing meditation at least try these ones at least a little bit, right? So you have these four meditations in your meditation arsenal at least a little bit. Even you might specialize in one or the other. First one is the unattractiveness of the body. They call asubha meditation. So this is like looking at the different parts of the body and so on. And so this is breaking down your attachment to your body. Yeah? So you look and you see, well, you know, what am I attached to? I look in the mirror and I think, wow, I'm just so beautiful. I could gaze at my lovely face all day and, oh, it's just so nice. And right, but what are you so attached to? Yeah, or maybe the opposite. Maybe you have, you know, I mean, this is a big problem these days. We get so many, you know, images in media and things like that. They're all kind of photoshopped images of perfect models and things like that. And you kind of obsess about, oh, I'll never be that skinny. Oh, my skin will never be that clear. You know, actually, they're not that skinny. And their skin is not that clear, and they actually have cellulite, and they actually have all these things, but, you know, if you could have a good help with Mr. Photoshop, then that could take all those things away from you as well. So, you know, these are just two sides of the same coin. So you look at, you know, and you reflect on your body and you say, actually, what is it? Hairs? You know, is that what I'm attached to? Nails? Skin? Spleen? You know? And so you just reflect on all these different parts. You realize, actually, it's just a body. It's no big deal. Everybody's got one. You know, there are minor variations from one to the other. But, you know, so what? At the end of the day, we're all going to end up in the same place. Yeah? So, this is a meditation on asubha, loving kindness, in metta meditation. Yeah? And so this overcoming anger, mindfulness of breathing, and that helps to still the mind and to quieten down the obsessive thinking of the mind and the perception of impermanence and each anupassana. And this, of course, leads to the developing wisdom, developing insight, and to overcoming of the concept of a self, yeah, concept of I am. So if you were doing like Mahasi technique and developing that, you know, Vipassana technique, then that comes under that fourth one of perception of impermanence, right? So that's what that's doing. And so that's just Mahasi technique is nothing more than a method to help you to develop that perception of impermanence. Yeah, so that's fine. There's nothing wrong. But you know, you might think, okay, maybe, you know, try to develop the other meditations as well, at least a little bit, see how they are, and then that might also be something to help complement. And these things will always help each other, right? They support each other. And so, you know, as in this example, when the Buddha's talking to Meghya, he didn't say to him, you know, only do one meditation and never do another. Actually, he gives him a number of different ones because they have a different purpose, okay? So, you know, the Buddhist tradition is very, very rich with different kinds of meditation. In the Visuddhimagga, it, you know, very famously gives a list of 40 different kinds of meditations, and that's just on the samatha side of things. That's not even including the Vipassana meditations, right? And that's also missing out quite a few as well. So there's actually even more than that. So if you want to do different meditations, you can keep on doing that until the cows come home, right? But they're all just leading to peace of mind, leading to wisdom, that's all. So these are the ones, these four are the ones that in the suttas it keeps on coming back to again and again and again, the really core, most important ones. So yeah, again, just to recommend that we all do these at least a little bit. Okay, I think it's time to have a break. Let's have a break until 9 o'clock, and then we can come back for the discussion. Okay, very good. So now is our time for the discussion, and so it's time to talk about meditation. And maybe you might think that talking about meditation is self-defeating. You should sit together and be silent about meditation, right? But you know, even though meditation is ultimately all about silence, and that you think about it, meditation is actually dependent on words. So we shouldn't disparage words. I mean, none of us could meditate if we'd never heard the word meditation, right? The words are what direct us towards the reality, yeah? And then words are not evil or bad, right? Thoughts are not evil or bad. They're just part of how the mind works. And so using our speech, using the words like meditation and so on, initially they're just concepts, they're just labels, right? But concepts and labels create reality, right? These words like meditation create realities, yeah? It changes your mind in very real ways. It creates books and Buddhist centers and retreat centers and all kinds of things that have all come from the idea of meditation. So actually, when we're practicing meditation, the words that we use to talk about it, the language that we have for meditation is quite important, and that can help us to deepen our practice. So this is what we're going to be doing in this next discussion section. We have these four meditations here. So what I want you to do is to break off into discussion groups as we have done before, and I want you to all take the chance, if you can get everybody in the group to talk about their own meditation a little bit, to say, you know, maybe they've done these kinds of meditations, maybe they've got some other kinds of meditations, and just to try to share a little bit about what your experience with meditation has been, and, you know, what you've got out of it, and what you perhaps hope to get out of it. And I think it's important because sometimes we can be a bit isolated in our practice, yeah? And I know that a lot of the time people may be in a family where maybe they might be the only meditator, or, you know, that people around them, they feel that they don't understand them. So it's good to get together now and then and to share those experiences. So this is what I want you to do, to share your meditation experiences, you know, whatever you feel comfortable with. Okay, so let's go. Divide into groups. Get some applause. Good. You know, soon we'll, you know, we have, these days people have meditation apps, right? And one of the last retreats that I did in Perth, usually when I start the retreat I ask, you know, if anybody's never meditated before, please come and we have a little meeting beforehand just to talk to the new meditators. And this one lady came along and she's like, I'm not sure, I've only ever meditated with apps before. Right, does that count? Right, so she's an app only meditator, right? So now we trust our phones enough to let them into our minds, right? And to dictate our spiritual progress, yeah? We have meditation apps. So this is an interesting kind of development. Of course, the next stage in that development will be that the apps will be reading our brains, right? And of course, you can actually already do that, right? That people have headsets and things like that. There's one firm in Australia called Emotive. It's run by a Vietnamese-Australian woman who's Buddhist, of course, and she sells these headsets, and they're going to read your brain, and you have like meditation apps and things you can download for this headset, so you can sort of program your head to meditate better based on this app. So then you could have like meditation competitions, couldn't you? Yeah, see, I am the serenest, yeah? And... So one of the things I wanted to have in this discussion, this idea that William James came up with, like the varieties of religious experience, but also just in the Buddhist context, you know, we have the varieties of meditative experience, don't we? And we sit around in those circles and discuss with our friends, people that we may know or don't know, and we hear many different kinds of things that happen in the meditation, yeah? And so some people have really amazing things happen, some people have really boring things happen, some people have very deep experiences, some people have very little experiences, and people have all these strange kinds of things that go on in their meditation. And I think it's very useful to share these things from time to time, because you realize that you may be weird, but you're not quite as weird as that guy is, right? And we all have these experiences, right? That's just how life is. The mind is weird and the mind is unpredictable. So sometimes when you share those experiences, sometimes we doubt and we worry about what's happening. But if you know that other people have had that, then that gives you a bit of comfort. And you know, one of the things that I think that came out to me in listening to people talking, and that's a really important part of the meditation experience, is that what meditation helps you to do is to, it helps you to see what's of value. It helps you to come back home to what's really important. Yeah, and we get so often, you know, we get distracted in business and work and shopping and all of those things, and then, you know, you come to meditation and those things drop away, and you just feel that like it's like a coming home, and you realize, oh, these are the things that really matter to me. And I think that's a really beautiful thing in meditation. So I think we might finish it up there. I didn't want to hear back from everybody because it would have taken probably a bit too long. But so we might wrap it up there. And tomorrow we'll have a look more at and detail at some of the teachings in the suttas on different aspects of meditation.